The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 3, Continued. Cassette 1, Side 2.
Their loudspeakers were never switched off from the morning chimes of the Spassky Belfry to the playing of the Internationale at midnight. And for them, the voice of the radio announcer Levitan became the voice of conscience. It was in the 30s that the working class merged completely with the petty bourgeoisie and became its main constituent part. I say to some extent, because labor legislation like the 20 minutes late decree and the tying of the workers to their factories enlisted no supporters. All the same, there was an urban minority, and not such a small one, numbering at the least several millions, who pulled out the radio plug in disgust whenever they dared. On every page of every newspaper, they saw merely a spreading stain of lies, and polling day for these millions was a day of suffering and humiliation. For this minority, the dictatorship existing in our country was neither proletarian nor national in character, nor yet, for those who recall the original sense of the word, Soviet, but the dictatorship of another minority, a usurping minority, which was very far from being a spiritual elite. Mankind is almost incapable of dispassionate, unemotional thinking. In something which he has recognized as evil, man can seldom force himself to see also what is good. Not everything in our lives was foul, not every word in the papers was false, but the minority, downtrodden, bullied, beset by stool pigeons, saw life in our country as an abomination from top to bottom, saw every page in the newspapers as one long lie. Let us recall that in those days there were no Western broadcasts in Russian, and the number of private radio sets was inconsiderable, so that a citizen could obtain information only from our newspapers and the official radio, in which Bronovitsky and his like expected from experience to find only cowardly suppression of facts or a vexatious tangle of lies. Everything that was written about other countries, about the inevitable collapse of the West in 1930, about the treachery of Western socialists, about the passionate hostility of all Spain to Franco, or in 1942 about Nehru's treasonable aspiration to freedom in India, which of course weakened our ally, the British Empire. All this proved to be nothing but lies. The maddeningly monotonous, hate-filled propaganda, conducted on the principle that he who is not for us is against us, had never drawn distinctions between the attitudes of Maria Spiridonova and Nicholas II, those of Leon Blum and Hitler, those of the British Parliament and the German Reichstag. So, when Bronovitsky read apparently fantastic stories about bonfires of books in German squares and the resurrection of some sort of ancient Teutonic savagery, we must not forget that Tsarist propaganda during the First World War had also told a few fibs about Teuton savagery. How could he be expected to distinguish them from all the rest, single them out as true, recognize in German Nazism, reviled in almost the same inordinate terms as Poincaré, Pilsudski, and the British Conservatives earlier? A quadruped as dangerous as that which in reality and in the flesh had for a quarter of a century past been squeezing the life out of him, poisoning his existence, clawing him till he bled, and with him the whole archipelago, the Russian town, the Russian village. Then the newspapers were forever changing their minds about the Hitlerites. At first it was friendly encounters between nice sentries in nasty Poland, and the newspapers were awash with sympathy for the valiant warriors standing up to French and English bankers, and Hitler's speeches verbatim filled a page of Pravda at a time. Then one morning, the second morning of the war, an explosion of headlines. All Europe was piteously groaning under the Nazi heel. This only confirmed that newspaper lies changed as the wind shifted, and could do nothing to persuade Bronovitsky that other butchers on this earth were a match for ours, about whom he knew the truth. If someone had tried to convince him by putting BBC bulletins before him daily, he might at most have been made to believe that Hitler was a secondary danger to Russia, but certainly not, while Stalin lived, the greatest. As it was, the BBC provided no bulletins. The Soviet Information Bureau from the day it was born commanded no more credit than TASS. The rumors carried by evacuees were not first-hand information. From Germany or from the occupied areas, no living witness had yet appeared. What he did know at first hand was the camp, Ajez Kazgan, and 1937, and the famine of 1932, and de-Kulakization, and the destruction of the churches. So that, as the German army approached, Bronowitzky, and tens of thousands of lonely individuals like him, felt that their hour was drawing near, the hour which they had ceased to hope for 20 years ago, which is given to a man only once, then lost forever, since our lives are so short measured against the slow pace of historical change. The hour in which he can repudiate what has befallen, what has been visited upon, flogged, and trampled into his people, serve in some way still obscure his agonized country, help to revise some sort of public life in Russia. Yes, Bronowitzky had remembered everything and forgiven nothing. He could never accept as his own a regime which had thrashed Russia unmercifully, brought it to collectivized beggary, to moral degeneracy, and now to a stunning military defeat. He choked with anger as he looked at naive creatures like me, like us, for it was beyond his power to convert us. He was waiting for someone, anyone, to take power in place of Stalin. The well-known psychological phenomenon of reaction to extremes, anything rather than the nauseous reality we know. Can we imagine anywhere in the world anyone worse than our rulers? Incidentally, this was in the Don region, where half the population were just as eagerly awaiting the Germans. So then Bronowitzky, who had been an apolitical being all his life, resolved in his seventh decade to make a political move. He consented to head the Morozovsk Municipal Authority. There, I think, he must quickly have seen what a silly situation he had landed himself in, seen that for the new arrivals Russia was even more insignificant and detestable than for those who had gone away, that the vampire needed only Russia's vital fluids, and that the body could wither and perish. The new burgomaster's task was to be in charge not of public-spirited Russians, but of auxiliaries to the German police. But he was fastened to the axle, and now, like it or not, he could only spin. Having freed himself from one lot of butchers, he must help another. The patriotic idea, which he had thought of as diametrically opposed to the Soviet idea, he suddenly saw fused with it. In some incomprehensible fashion, patriotism had slipped away like water through a sieve from the minority who had preserved it, and passed to the majority. It was forgotten how people had been shot for patriotism, how it had been ridiculed, and now it was the main stem of someone else's tree. He, and others like him, must have felt trapped and terrified. The crack had narrowed, and the only way out led to death or to katorga. Of course, they were not all Bronowitzkys. Of course, many birds of prey, greedy for power and blood, had flocked to that brief feast in time of plague. But their like will flock wherever there are pickings. They were very much at home in the NKVD, too. Such a one was Mamulov, or Antonov, at Dudinsk, or Poisri Shapka. Can anyone imagine fouler butchers? Yet they lauded it for decades and bled the people dry 100 times over. We shall shortly meet Warder Tkach, and one of those who managed to fit into both contexts. We have been talking about the towns, but we should not forget the countryside. Liberals nowadays commonly reproach the village with its political obtuseness and conservatism. But before the war, the village, to a man, or overwhelmingly, was sober, much more sober than the town. It took no part at all in the deification of Daddy Stalin, and needless to say had no time for world revolution either. The village was, quite simply, sane, and remembered clearly how it had been promised land, then robbed of it, how it had lived, eaten, and dressed before and after collectivization, how calves, ewes, and even hens had been taken away from the peasant's yard, how churches had been desecrated and defiled. Even in 1941, the radio's nasal bray was not yet heard in peasant huts, and not every village had even one person able to read the newspapers. so that to the Russian countryside all those Chang Tso-lins, MacDonalds and Hitlers were indistinguishably strange and meaningless lay figures. In a village in Ryazan province on July the 3rd, 1941, peasants gathered near the smithy were listening to Stalin's speech relayed by a loudspeaker. The man of iron, hitherto unmoved by the tears of Russian peasants, was now a bewildered old gaffer, almost in tears himself, and as soon as he blurted out his humbugging brothers and sisters, one of the peasants answered the black paper mouthpiece, "This is what you want, you bastard!" And he made in the direction of the loudspeaker a rude gesture much favoured by Russians. One hand grips the opposite elbow, and the forearm rises and falls in a pumping motion. The peasants all roared with laughter. If we questioned eyewitnesses in every village, we should learn of 10,000 such incidents, some still more pungent. Such was the mood of the Russian village at the beginning of the war, the mood, then, of the reservists drinking the last half-litre and dancing in the dust with their kinsmen while they waited at some wayside halt for a train. On top of all this came a defeat without precedent in Russian memories, as vast rural areas stretching to the outskirts of both capitals and to the Volga, as many millions of peasants slipped from under Kolkhoz's rule, and, why go on lying and prettifying history, it turned out that the republics only wanted independence, the village only wanted freedom from the Kolkhoz, the workers' freedom from feudal decrees. If the newcomers had not been so hopelessly arrogant and stupid, if they had not preserved the bureaucratic Kolkhoz administration for great Germany's convenience, if they had not conceived the obscene idea of turning Russia into a colony, the patriotic cause would not have devolved on those who had always tried to smother it, and we should hardly have been called upon to celebrate the 25th anniversary of Russian communism. Somebody, someday, will have to tell us how the peasants in occupied areas never joined the partisan movement of their own free will, and how, to begin with, they took up arms against the partisans rather than hand over their grain and cattle. Do you remember the great exodus from the Northern Caucasus in January 1943? And can you think of any analogy in world history? A civilian population, and a peasant population at that, leaving with a defeated enemy, with an alien army, rather than stay behind with the victors, their fellow countrymen, the wagon trains rolling as far as the eye could see through the fierce, icy January winds. Here, too, lie the social roots of those hundreds of thousands of volunteers who, monster though Hitler was, were desperate enough to don enemy uniform. The time has come for us to give our views on the Vlasov movement once again. In the first part of this book, the reader was not yet prepared for the whole truth, nor am I in possession of the whole truth. Special studies will be written on the subject, which is for me of secondary importance. There, at the beginning, before the reader had travelled the high roads and by roads of the camp world with me, he was merely alerted, invited to think. Now, after all those prison transports, transit jails, lumber gangs and camp middens, perhaps the reader will be a little more open to persuasion. In part one, I spoke of those Vlasovites who took up arms in desperation because they were starving in camps, because their position seemed hopeless. Yet even here there is room for reflection. The Germans began by using Russian prisoners of war only for non-military tasks in the rear, in support of their own troops, and this, you might think, was the best solution for those who only wanted to save their skins. So why did they take up arms and confront the Red Army head-on? But now, since further postponement is impossible, should I not also talk about those who even before 1941 had only one dream, to take up arms and blaze away at those Red Commissars, Czechists and collectivizers? Remember Lenin's words. An oppressed class which did not aspire to possess arms and learn how to handle them would deserve only to be treated as slaves. Fourth edition, volume 23, page 85. There is, then, reason to be proud of the Soviet-German war showed that we are not such slaves as all those studies by liberal historians contemptuously make us out to be. There was nothing slavish about those who reached for their sabres to cut off Daddy Stalin's head, nor about those on the other side who've straightened their backs for the first time when they put on Red Army greatcoats, in a strange, brief interval of freedom which no student of society could have foreseen. These people, who had experienced on their own hides 24 years of communist happiness, knew by 1941 what as yet no one else in the world knew, that nowhere on the planet, nowhere in history, was there a regime more vicious, more bloodthirsty, and at the same time more cunning and ingenious than the Bolshevik, the self-styled Soviet regime. That no other regime on earth could compare with it either in the number of those it had done to death, in hardiness, in the range of its ambitions, in its thoroughgoing and unmitigated totalitarianism. No, not even the regime of its pupil Hitler, which at that time blinded Western eyes to all else. Came the time when weapons were put in the hands of these people. Should they have curbed their passions, allowed Bolshevism to outlive itself, steeled themselves to cruel oppression again, and only then begun the struggle with it? A struggle which has still hardly started anywhere in the world. No, the natural thing was to copy the methods of Bolshevism itself. It had eaten into the body of a Russia sucked by the First World War, and it must be defeated at a similar moment in the Second. Our unwillingness to fight had already shown itself in the Soviet-Finnish War of 1939. B.G. Bazhanov, formerly secretary of the Politburo and Orgburo of the CPSUB, and Stalin's close assistant, tried to exploit this mood, to turn captured Red Army men against the Soviet lines under the command of Russian émigré officers, not to fight their compatriots, but to convert them. The attempt was abruptly terminated by the sudden capitulation of Finland. When the Soviet-German War began, 10 years after the slaughterers' collectivization, 8 years after the great Ukrainian famine, 6 million dead, unnoticed by neighboring Europe, 4 years after the devil's dance of the NKVD, 1 year after the workers were shackled to the new labor laws, and all this when there were 15 million in camps about the country, and while the older generation all clearly remembered what life was like before the revolution, the natural impulse of the people was to take a deep breath and liberate itself, its natural feeling one of loathing for its rulers. Caught us unawares, numerical superiority in aircraft and tanks. In fact, all round numerical superiority was enjoyed by the Red Army. It was not this that enabled the enemy to close so easily those disastrous salients, taking 300,000 armed men at a time, Bialystok, Smolensk, or 650,000, Bryansk, Kiev. Not this that caused whole fronts to cave in and rolled our armies back farther and faster than anything Russia had seen in all its 1,000 years, or probably any other country in any other war. Not this, but the instant paralysis of a paltry regime whose subjects recoiled from it as from a hanging corpse. The Reichoms and Gorkoms were blown away in 5 minutes, and Stalin was gasping for breath. In 1941, this upheaval might have run its full course. By December, 60 million Soviet people out of a population of 150 million were no longer in Stalin's power. The alarmist note in Stalin's order number 0019, July the 16th, 1941, was justified. On all fronts, there are numerous elements who even run to meet the enemy and throw down their arms at the first contact with him. In the Bialystok salient in July 1941, among 340,000 prisoners, there were 20,000 deserters. Stalin thought the situation so desperate that in October 1941, he sent a telegram to Churchill suggesting that 25 to 30 British divisions be landed on Soviet territory. What communist has ever suffered a more complete moral collapse? This was the mood of the time. On August the 22nd, 1941, the commanding officer of the 436th Light Infantry Regiment, Major Kononov, told his regiment to their faces that he was going over to the Germans to join the Liberation Army for the overthrow of Stalin, and invited all who wished to go with him. Not only did he meet with no opposition, the whole regiment followed him. Only 3 weeks later, Kononov had created a regiment of Cossack volunteers behind the enemy lines. He was a Don Cossack himself. When he arrived at the prisoner of war camp near Mogilev to enlist volunteers, 4,000 of the 5,000 prisoners there declared their readiness to join him, but he could not take them all. In the same year, half the Soviet prisoners of war in the camp near Tilsit, 12,000 men, signed a declaration that the time had come to convert the war into a civil war. We have not forgotten how the whole population of Lokotbryensky, before the arrival of the Germans and independently of them, joined in the creation of an autonomous Russian local administration over a large and flourishing province with 8 districts and more than 1 million inhabitants. The demands of the Lokotbryansky community were quite precise. A Russian national government to be established, Russians to administer themselves in all the occupied provinces, Russia to be declared independent within its 1938 frontiers, a liberation army to be formed under Russian command. Or again, a group of young people in Leningrad, numbering more than 1,000, led by the student Rutchenko, went out in the woods near Gatchina to await the Germans and fight against the Stalin regime. The Germans, however, sent them behind the lines to work as drivers and kitchen orderlies. The Germans were met with bread and salt in the villages on the Don. The pre-1941 population of the Soviet Union naturally imagined that the coming of a foreign army meant the overthrow of the communist regime, otherwise it could have no meaning for us at all. People expected a political program which would liberate them from Bolshevism. From where we were, separated from them by the wilderness of Soviet propaganda, by the dense mass of Hitler's army, how could we readily believe that the Western Allies had entered this war not for the sake of freedom in general, but for their own Western European freedom, only against Nazism, intending to take full advantage of the Soviet armies and leave it at that? Was it not more natural for us to believe that our allies were true to the very principle of freedom, and that they would not abandon us to a worse tyranny? True, these were the same allies for whom Russians had died in the First World War, and who then, too, had abandoned our army in the moment of collapse, hastening back to their comforts. But this was a lesson too cruel for the heart to learn. Having rightly taught ourselves to disbelieve Soviet propaganda, whatever it said, we naturally did not believe tall stories about the Nazis wishing to make Russia a colony and ourselves German slaves. Who would expect to find such foolishness in 20th century heads, unless he had experienced its effects for himself? Even in 1942, the Russian formation in Osintorf attracted more volunteers than a unit still not fully deployed could absorb, while in the Smolensk region and Byelorussia, a volunteer people's militia, 100,000 strong, was formed for purposes of self-defense against the partisans directed from Moscow. The Germans took fright and banned it. As late as spring 1943, on his 2 propaganda tours in the Smolensk and Pskov regions, Vlasov was greeted with enthusiasm wherever he went. Even then, the population was still waiting and wondering when we should have our own independent government and our own army. I have testimony from the Posherevitsky district of the Pskov Oblast about the friendly attitude of the peasant population to the Vlasov unit there, which refrained from looting and brawling, wore the old Russian uniform, helped with the harvest, and was regarded as a Russian organ of authority opposed to Kolkhozes. Volunteers from among the civilian population came to sign on, just as they did in Lokotbryansky with Voskobojnikov's unit, and we are bound to wonder what made them do so. It was not as though they were getting out of a POW camp. In fact, the Germans several times forbade Vlasovites to take in reinforcements, let them sign on with the Polizei. As late as March 1943, prisoners of war in a camp near Kharkov read leaflets about the Vlasov movement, so-called, and 730 officers signed an application to join the Russian Liberation Army. They had the experience of 2 years of war behind them. Many were heroes of the battle for Stalingrad. Their numbers included divisional commanders and regimental commissars. Moreover, the camp was very well fed, and it was not the desperation of hunger that induced them to sign. The Germans, however, behaved with typical stupidity. Of the 730 who signed, 722 had still not been released from the camp and given a chance to act when the war ended. Even in 1943, tens of thousands of refugees from the Soviet provinces trailed along behind the retreating German army. Anything was better than remaining under communism. I will go so far as to say that our folk would have been worth nothing at all, a nation of abject slaves, if it had gone through that war without brandishing a rifle at Stalin's government, even from afar, if it had missed its chance to shake its fist and fling a ripe oath at the father of the peoples. The Germans had their general's plot, but what did we have? Our generals were, and remain to this day, non-entities, corrupted by party ideology and greed, and have not preserved in their own persons the spirit of the nation, as happens in other countries. So that those who raised their hands and struck were almost to a man from the lowest levels of society. The number of former gentry émigrés, former members of the wealthier strata, and intellectuals taking part was microscopically small. If this movement had been allowed to develop unhindered, to flow with the same forces in the first weeks of the war, it would have been like a second Pugachev rising, resembling the first in the numbers and social level of those swept in its train, in the weight of popular support, in the part played by the Cossacks, in spirit, its determination to settle accounts with evildoers in high places, in the contrast between its elemental force and the weakness of its leadership. However this may be, it was very much more a movement of the people, the common people, than the whole liberation movement of the intelligentsia from the beginning of the 20th century right up to February 1917, with its pseudo-popular aims and its harvest in October. It was not, however, destined to run its course, but to perish ignominiously, stigmatized as treason to our holy motherland. We have lost the taste for social analysis of events, because such explanations are juggled around to suit the need of the moment. But what of our friendship pact with Ribbentrop and Hitler, the braggadocio of Molotov and Voroshilov before the war, and then the staggering incompetence, the unpreparedness, the fumbling, and the craven flight of the government from Moscow, the armies abandoned, 500,000 at a time, in the salients? Was this not betrayal of the motherland, with more serious consequences? Why do we cherish these traitors so tenderly in their apartments on Granovsky Street? Oh, the length of it, the length of the prisoner's bench with seats for all those who tormented and betrayed our people, if we could bring them all, from first to last, to account. Awkward questions get no answers in our country. They are passed over in silence. Instead, this is the sort of thing they yell at us. It's the very principle of the thing. Does any Russian, to achieve his own political ends, however just they appear to him, have the right to lean on the strong right arm of German imperialism? And that at the moment of war to the death? True enough, this is the crucial question. Ought you, for what seem to you noble ends, to avail yourself of the support of German imperialists at war with Russia? Today, everyone will join in a unanimous cry of no. What, then, of the sealed German carriage from Switzerland to Sweden, calling on the way, as we have now learned, at Berlin? The whole Russian press, from the Mensheviks to the cadets, also cried, no, but the Bolsheviks explained that it was permissible, that it was indeed ridiculous to reproach them with it. But this is not the only train journey worth mentioning. How many railroad cars did the Bolsheviks rush out of Russia in summer 1918, some carrying foodstuffs, others gold, all of them into Wilhelm's capacious moor. Convert the war into a civil war. This was Lenin's proposal before the Vlasovites thought of it. Yes, but his aims. Remember what his aims were. Well, what were they? And what has become of them, those aims? Yes, but really, that was Wilhelm, the Kaiser, the little emperor, a bit different from Hitler. And anyway, was there really any government in Russia at the time? The provisional government doesn't count. Well, there was a time when, inflamed with martial ardor, we never mentioned the Kaiser in print without the words ferocious or bloodthirsty, and incautiously accused the Kaiser's soldiers of smashing the heads of babes against stones. But let's agree, The Kaiser was different from Hitler. The provisional government, though, was also different. It had no checker, shot no one in the back of the head, imprisoned no one in camps, herded no one into collective farms, poisoned no one's life. The provisional government was not Stalin's government. We must keep things in proportion. It was not that someone took fright as Katorga killed off one alphabet after another, but simply that, with the war drawing to an end, there was no need for such a savage deterrent. No new Polizei units could be formed, working hands were needed, and in Katorga people were dying off uselessly. So, as early as 1945, huts in Katorga ceased to be prison cells. Doors were opened to let in the daylight. Slop buckets were carried out to the latrines. Prisoners were allowed to make their own way to the medical section and were trotted to the mess hall at the double to keep their spirits up. The thieves who used to filch other prisoners' rations were removed and mess orderlies appointed from among the politicals themselves. Later on, prisoners were allowed to receive letters, 2 a year. The line between Katorga and the ordinary camps became blurred in the years 1946 to 1947. Unfastidious managing engineers did not let political distinctions stand in the way of plan fulfillment and began, in Vorkuta at least, to transfer political offenders with good qualifications to ordinary camp divisions, where nothing but the numbers on their backs reminded them of Katorga, while rank-and-file manual laborers from corrective labor camps were shoved into Katorga to fill the gaps. In this way, the thoughtless managers might have thwarted Stalin's great idea of resurrecting Katorga, except that in 1948 a new idea came to him just in time, that of dividing the natives of Gulag into distinct groups, separating the socially acceptable thieves and delinquents from the socially irredeemable 58s. All this was part of a still greater concept, the reinforcement of the home front. It is obvious from the choice of words that Stalin was preparing for war in the near future. Special camps were set up with a special regime, slightly milder than that of the Katorga earlier on, but harsher than that of the ordinary camps. To distinguish them from other camps, fantastic poetical titles were invented for them instead of ordinary geographical names. Such new creations included Gorlag at Norilsk, Berlag on the Kolyma, Minlag on the Inter, Rechlag on the Pechora, Dubrovlag at Potma, Odzerlag at Taishet, Steplag, Peshanlag, and Luglag in Kazakhstan, Kamishlag in Kemerovo province. Dark rumors crept around the corrective labor camps that 58s would be sent to special extermination camps. It did not, of course, enter the heads either of those carrying out the orders or of the victims that any formal additional sentences might be necessary. The registration and distribution and the security operations sections worked furiously. Secret lists were made and driven away somewhere for approval. Long red prisoner transport trains were moved in. Companies of brisk red-tabbed guards marched up with Tommy guns, dogs, and hammers, and the enemies of the people, as their names were called, meekly obeyed the inexorable summons to leave their cozy huts and begin the long transit. But not all 58s were summoned. It was only later, comparing notes on their acquaintances, that the prisoners realized which of them had been left behind on corrective labor islands with the minor offenders. Among them were those convicted under Article 58, Section 10, with no further charges. This covered simple anti-Soviet agitation, which meant that it was a gratuitous act, without accomplices, and not aimed at anyone in particular. Though it may seem almost impossible to imagine such agitators, millions of them were on the books and were left behind on the older islands of Gulag. Agitators who had formed duets or trios, shown any inclination to listen to each other, to exchange views, or to grumble in chorus, had been burdened with an additional charge under Article 58, Section 11, on hostile groups, and as the leaven of anti-Soviet organizations now went off to special camps. So, needless to say, did traitors to the motherland, 58 1A and 1B, bourgeois nationalists and separatists, 58 2, agents of the international bourgeoisie, 58 4, spies, 58 6, subversives, 58 7, terrorists, 58 8, wreckers, 58.9, and Economic Saboteurs, 58.14. This was also the most convenient place to put those prisoners of war, German, in Minlag, or Japanese, in Utzelag, whom it was intended to detain beyond 1948. On the other hand, non-informers, 58.12, and abettors of the enemy, 58.3, in corrective labor camps remained where they were, whereas prisoners in Katorga, sentenced specifically for aiding and abetting the enemy, now went to the special camps with all the rest. The wisdom of the separators was even harder to fathom than appears from this description. Criteria still unexplained left in the corrective labor category female traitors serving 25 years, Unschlag, and here and there whole camp divisions including nothing but 58s, Blasevites, and ex-polizei among them. These were not special camps, the prisoners wore no numbers, but the regime was severe. Krasnaya Glinka on the Samara bend of the Volga, the Tuim camp in the Shirin district of Kakassia, and the southern Sakhalin camp were examples. These camps were so harsh that prisoners would have been no worse off in the special camps. So that the archipelago, once the great partition had been carried out, should never again lapse into confusion, it was provided from 1949 onward that every newly naturalized immigrant from the world outside should have written in his prison book, apart from his sentence, a ruling of the state security authorities and the prosecutor's office in the oblast as to the type of cage in which this particular bird should always be kept. Thus, like the seed that dies to produce a plant, Stalin's katorga grew into the special camp. The red prisoner transport trains travelled the length and breadth of the motherland and the archipelago, carrying the new intake. At Inta, they had the sense simply to drive the herd out of one gate and in through another. Chekhov complained that we had no legal definition of katorga or of its purpose. But that was in the enlightened 19th century. In the middle of the 20th, the caveman century, we didn't even feel a need to understand and define. Old man Stalin had decided that it would be so, and that was all the definition necessary. We just nodded our heads in understanding. Chapter 2. The First Whiff of Revolution. Dismayed by the hopeless length of my sentence, stunned by my first acquaintance with the world of Gulag, I could never have believed at the beginning of my time there that my spirit would recover by degrees from its dejection, that as the years went by I should ascend, so gradually that I was hardly aware of it myself, to an invisible peak of the archipelago, as though it were Mauna Loa on Hawaii, and from there gaze serenely over distant islands and even feel the lure of the treacherous, shimmering sea between. The middle part of my sentence I served on a golden isle, where prisoners were given enough to eat and drink, and kept warm and clean. In return for all this, not much was required of me, just 12 hours a day sitting at a desk and making myself agreeable to the bosses. But clinging to these good things suddenly became distasteful. I was groping for some new way to make sense of prison life. Looking around me, I realize now how contemptible was the advice of the special assignment prisoner from Krasnaya Preznia. At all costs, steer clear of general duties. The price we were paying seemed disproportionately high. Prison released in me the ability to write, and I now gave all my time to this passion, brazenly neglecting my boring office work. There was something I had come to value more than the butter and sugar they gave me, standing on my own feet again. Well, they jerked a few of us to our feet, en route to a special camp. They took a long time getting us there, 3 months. It could be done more quickly with horses in the 19th century. So long that this journey became, as it were, a distinct period in my life, and it even seems to me that my character and outlook changed in the course of it. The journey was bracing, cheerful, full of good omens. A freshening breeze buffeted our faces, the wind of katorga and of freedom. People and incidents pressed in on every hand to assure us that justice was on our side. On our side. On our side. not with our judges and jailers. The Butyrki, our old home, greeted us with a heart-rending female shriek from a window, probably that of a solitary confinement cell. "Help! Save me! They're killing me! They're killing me!" Then the cries were choked in a warder's hands. At the Butyrki station, we were mixed up with raw recruits of the 1949 intake. They all had funny sentences, not the usual tenors, but quarters. When at each of the numerous roll calls they had to give dates of release, it sounded like a cruel joke. October 1974, February 1975. No one surely could sit out such a sentence. A man must get hold of some pliers and cut the wire. These 25-year sentences were enough to transform the prisoner's world. The holders of power had bombarded us with all they had. Now it was the prisoner's turn to speak freely, uninhibitedly, undeterred by threats, the words we had never heard in our lives and which alone could enlighten and unite us. We were sitting in a Stolypin car at the Kazan station when we heard from the station loudspeaker that war had broken out in Korea. After penetrating a firm South Korean defense line to a depth of 10 kilometers on the very first day, the North Koreans insisted that they had been attacked. Any imbecile who had been at the front understood that the aggressors were those who had advanced on the first day. This war in Korea excited us even more. In our rebellious mood, we longed for the storm. The storm must break. It must, or else we were doomed to a lingering death. Somewhere past Ryazan, the red rays of the rising sun struck with such force through the mole's-eye windows of the prison car that the young guard in the corridor near our gratings screwed up his eyes. Our guards might have been worse. They had crammed us into compartments 15 or so at a time. They fed us on herring. But to be fair, they also brought us water and let us out morning and evening to relieve ourselves, so that we should have had no quarrel with them. If this lad hadn't unthinkingly, not maliciously, tossed the words, "enemies of the people," at us. That started it. Our compartment and the next pitched into him. "All right, we're enemies of the people, but why is there no grub on the Kolkots? You're a country boy yourself by the look of you, but I bet you'll sign on again. I bet you'd sooner be a dog on a chain than go back to the plough." "If we're enemies of the people, why paint the prison bands different colours? Who are you hiding us from?" "Listen, kid, I had two like you who never came back from the war, and you call me an enemy of the people?" It was a very long time since words like this had flown through the bars of our cages. We shouted only the plainest of facts, too self-evident to be refuted. A sergeant, serving extra time, came to the aid of the flustered youngster, but instead of hauling anyone off to the cooler or taking names, he tried to help his subordinate to fight back. Here, too, we saw a faint hint that times were changing. No, this was 1950, too soon to speak of better times. What we saw were signs of the new relationship between prisoners and jailers created by the new long sentences and the new political camps. Our argument began to take on the character of a genuine debate. The young men took a good look at us and could no longer bring themselves to call us or those in the next compartment enemies of the people. They tried trotting out bits from newspapers and from their elementary politics course, but their ears told them before their minds could that these set phrases rang false. "Look for yourselves, lads. Look out the window," was the answer they got from us. "Look what you've brought Russia down to." Beyond the windows stretched a beggarly land of rotted thatch and rickety huts and ragged folk. We were on the Rutsayev line, by which foreigners never travel. If the Golden Horde had seen it so befouled, they would not have bothered to conquer it. On the quiet station at Torbayevo, an old man walked along the platform in bast shoes. This book is continued on Cassette 2, Side 1.